Before It continues with Session 7, An Introduction to Hinduism.
Now, today I am going to go into the very fundamental guts of Hinduism. But what I want to do is to begin with certain documents that are known as the Upanishads. U-P-A-N-I-S-H-A-D, or plural, Upanishad. A word which means something like initiatic instruction, freely translated. And these documents constitute what is called Vedanta, V-E-D-A-N-T-A, and that is compounded of two words, Veda, Anta. Anta means end or completion or summation. Veda, of course, is related to the Latin video, to see. Veda is the fundamental revelation of the Hindu way of life, contained in its earliest scriptural documents, which are generally dated in the period between 1500 and 1200 BC. The Upanishads, as being the summation of the Veda, are found from over a long period of time, beginning perhaps as early as 800 BC. Some of the Upanishads are much, much later than that. However, there is always a doubt in connection with the dating of any Hindu text, because unlike the Hebrews, the Hindus have absolutely no sense of history. They view time as circular, as something that goes round and round and round again and again, so that what happens today is on the whole very much like what happened yesterday, 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. They view life as a repetitious process of cycles, and so there is very little internal evidence in Hindu manuscripts to give us a terminus ad quem or a quo, dates between which we can say it must have been written. So little were they interested in references to contemporary events. In fact, until relatively recent times, history was little more than keeping chronicles, and the Hindus were not overly interested in keeping chronicles, at least not so much as the Chinese. So there's a great deal of vagueness. This is added to by the fact that many of these scriptures were, for hundreds of years, handed down orally and memorized before ever being committed to writing. So there's a great deal of vagueness as to how old the tradition is with which we are dealing. It may be earlier than scholars generally suppose. It may even be later. But at any rate, it seems that there was a migration into the Indian subcontinent by peoples from the north who call themselves Aryans, which may have occurred somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, 1500 to 1200 BC, and that they brought with them the Vedic tradition, which merged with whatever aboriginal religions or ways of life were existing on the subcontinent at that time, and produced the complex which today we call Hinduism. So in the Upanishads, I'm not going into the Vedas because that is a complicated piece of symbolical interpretation having to do with the rites, the hymns, and the myths of the various so-called gods of the Hindu pantheon, gods which in the philosophy of the Upanishads are seen simply as so many different manifestations of one basic principle, which is called Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, derived from the root bri, which means to expand or to grow. And Brahman is also called Atman or Paramatman, A-T-M-A-N, that's a neuter form, the Self. Paramatman, the Supreme Self, the which than which there is no witcher. And the basic position of the Upanishads is that the Self is the one and only reality without a second, that all this universe is finally Brahman and appears to be a multiplicity of different things and different events only by reason of Maya, which is illusion, magic, art, creative power. So then, it is basic to the Vedanta that Brahman, this intangible, non-objective ground of everything that exists, is identical with the ground of you. This, of course, is a doctrine which is very difficult for those brought up in the Judeo-Christian traditions to accept, because it is fundamental to Christian and Jewish theology that whatever you are surely not the Lord God. And Christians feel about the Hindu doctrine that we are all fundamentally masks of God, that it's pantheism, and that's a dirty word in Christian theological circles, because of the feeling that if everything is God, then all moral standards are blown to hell. Because it means everything is as good as everything else. Everything that happens is really God, and this must include the good things and the bad things. And that seems to them a very dangerous idea. Actually, all religious doctrines contain very, very dangerous ideas. However, we won't worry about that for the moment, because what the Hindu means by God when he says Brahman is not at all the same thing as a Jew means by the Lord Adonai, because the Jew and the Christian means the boss, to whom divine honors are due as above all others. The Hindu, on the other hand, does not mean the boss. He doesn't mean the king, the lord, the political ruler of the universe. He means the inmost energy, which, as it were, dances this whole universe, without, as it were, the idea of authority, of governing some intractable element that resists his or its power. So then, why, the great problem arises, does it appear that we are not? Why do we think, why do we have the sensory impression that this whole universe consists of a vast multiplicity of different things, and we don't see it all as one? Well, what would you think it would be like to see it all as one? I know a lot of people who study Oriental philosophy hear about attaining these great states of consciousness, nirvana, moksha, which the Hindus use, liberation, satori, Zen Buddhist word for enlightenment or awakening. What would it be like to have that? How would you feel if you saw everything is really one basic reality? Well, a lot of people think that it would be as if all the outlines and differentiations in the field of vision suddenly became vague, melted, and we saw only a kind of luminous sea of light. But rather advisedly, the Vedanta philosophy does not really seriously use the word one of the Supreme Self. Because the word and the idea one has an opposite, many, on one side, and another opposite, none, on the other. And it is fundamental to Vedanta that the Supreme Self is neither one nor many, but, as they say, non-dual. And they express that in this word, Advaita. A is a negative word, like non. Dvaita is from dva, same as the Latin duo, two. So Advaita is non-dual. And this, at first, for Westerners, is a difficult conception. Because you naturally, as a Western logician would say, but the non-dual is the opposite of the dual. Therefore it has an opposite. True. But the Hindu is using this term in a special sense. It's like this. On a flat surface, I have only two dimensions in which to operate. So that everything drawn in two dimensions has only two dimensions. How, therefore, on a two-dimensional level, can I draw anything but two dimensions? How, in logic, in human rationality, can I possibly think except in terms of opposites? All rational discourse is talk about classification. The classification of experiences, of sensations, of notions. And the nature of a class is that it's a box. And if a box has an inside, it has to have an outside. Is you is, or is you ain't, is fundamental to all classification. And we can't get out of it. We can't talk about a class of all classes and make any sense about it. It's almost as if, you see, whatever we see to be different is an explicit difference on the surface, covering an implicit unity. Only, it's very difficult to talk about what it is that unifies black and white. Of course, in a way, the eyes do. Sound and silence are unified by the ears. So, you can see, can't you, that if you can't have one without the other, it's like the poles of a magnet, North Pole and South Pole. You can't have a one-pole magnet. True, the poles are quite different. One's north and the other's south. But it's all one magnet. And some such idea as that is what the Hindu is moving into when he's speaking of the real basis or ground of the universe as being non-dual. Take it, the fundamental opposition that I suppose all of us feel between self and other, I and thou, I and it. There is something that is me, there's an area of my experience that I call myself, and there's an other area of my experience which I call not myself. But you will immediately see that neither one could be realized without the other. You wouldn't know what you meant by self unless you experienced something other than self. You wouldn't know what you meant by other unless you understood self. They go together. They arise at the same time. You don't have first self and then other, or first other and then self. They come together. And that shows, you see, the sneaky conspiracy underneath the two, like the magnet between the two different poles. And so more or less that, sort of what isn't classifiable, but which lies between all classes. The class of elephants opposite the class of non-elephants has, as it were, the walls of the box joining the two together. Just as your skin is an osmotic membrane that joins you to the external world by virtue of all the tubes in it, and the nerve ends, and the way in which the external energies flow through your skin into your inside, and vice versa. But we do, don't we, see and feel and sense, or we think we do, the world as divided into a great multiplicity. A lot of people would think of the universe as a collection of different things, a kind of cosmic flotsam and jetsam washed together in this particular area of space, and prefer to take a pluralistic attitude and don't see anything underlying. In fact, in contemporary logical philosophy, the notion of any basic ground or continuum in which all events occur would be considered meaningless, for obvious reasons. If I say that every body in this universe, every star, every planet, is moving in a certain direction at a uniform speed, that will be saying nothing at all unless I can point out some other object with respect to which they are so moving. But since I said the universe, that includes all objects whatsoever. Therefore, I cannot make a meaningful statement about the uniform behavior of everything that is going on. True. But on the other hand, every sound you hear on the radio, whether it be a honking horn, a Bach sonata, or a newscast, is the vibration of the diaphragm in your loudspeaker. The radio doesn't tell us this. The announcer doesn't come on first thing in the morning and say, ladies and gentlemen, from now until closing time, all the sounds you will hear will be vibrations of the diaphragm in your speaker. That is taken for granted and ignored. So, in the same way, your eardrum is basic to all that you hear. Your lens of the eye and retina is basic to all that you see. What is the color of the lens of the eye? We say it has no color. It is transparent. In the same way as a mirror has no color of its own. But the mirror is very definitely there, colorless as it may be. The eardrum, unheard as it may be, is very definitely basic to all hearing. The eye, transparent as it may be, is very definitely basic to all seeing. So therefore, if there were some continuum in which everything that is going on and everything that we experience occurs, we would not notice it. We would not be able, really, to say very much about it, except perhaps that it was there. It wouldn't make any difference to anything, except the one all-important difference, that if it wasn't there, there wouldn't be any differences. But you see, philosophers nowadays don't like to think about things like that. It stretches their heads, and they would rather preoccupy themselves with more pedestrian matters. But still, you can't help it. If you're a human being, you wonder about things like that. What is it in which everything is happening? What is the ground? Well, you say, obviously it's not a what, because a thing that is a what is a classifiable thing. And so, very often the Hindu and the Buddhist will refer to the ultimate reality as no thing. Not nothing, but no special thing. Unclassifiable. Can't put your finger on it. But it's you. It's what you basically are. What everything basically is. Just as the sound of an automobile horn on the radio is in one way an automobile horn, but basically it is the vibration of the diaphragm. Okay, so you are all, in the Hindu view, vibrations of the entire cosmic diaphragm. Put it like that. That's analogy. The best language is say nothing, but to experience it. How can you experience it? The nub of all these Oriental philosophies is not an idea, not a theory, not even a way of behaving, but it's basically a way of experiencing, a transformation of everyday consciousness, so that it becomes quite apparent to us that that's the way things are. But when it happens to you, it's very difficult to explain it. So in exactly the same way, when somebody has that sort of breakthrough which transforms his consciousness, And it happens all over the world. It's not just a Hindu phenomenon. When somebody suddenly realizes it's all one, or technically non-dual, and really all this coming and going and all this frantic living and dying, grabbing, struggling, fighting, suffering, all this is a fantastic phantasmagoria. He sees that. But when he tries to explain it, he finds his mouth isn't big enough. Because he can't get the words out of their dualistic pattern to explain something non-dualistic. Well, why is this so? Why are we under this great, magnificent hallucination? Well, the Hindus explain this in Saguna language as follows. It's a very nice explanation. A child can understand it. The fact of the matter is that the world is a game of hide and seek. Peekaboo. Now you see it, now you don't. Because, very obviously, if you were the Supreme Self, what would you do? I mean, would you just sit there and be blissfully one and everything forever and ever and ever? Well, obviously not. You would play games. And you'd get lost. And you'd get involved in all sorts of adventures. And you'd forget who you were. Just as when you play a game, you're playing poker. And although you're only playing for dimes or for chips, you get absorbed in the game. And you nothing really important to win, nothing really important to lose, and yet it becomes fantastically interesting. Who wins and who loses. And so in the same way it is said that the Supreme Self gets absorbed through ever so many different channels, which we call all the different beings, in the plot, just like an artist or a writer gets completely absorbed in the artistic creation that he's doing, or an actor gets absorbed in the part in the drama. He's going to have you sitting on the edge of your chair. He's going to have you crying. He's going to have you trembling. Because he almost persuades you that it's real. And what would happen if the very best actor was confronted by the very best audience? Why, they'd be taken in completely. And the one would confirm the other. So this is the idea of the universe as drama. That the fundamental self, the Saguna Brahman, plays this game, gets involved in being all of us, and does it so damn well, it's so superbly acted that the thing appears to be real. And we're not only sitting on the edge of our chair, but we start to get up and throw things. We join in the drama, and it all becomes whatever it is that's going on here, you see? Then, of course, at the end of the drama, because all things have to have an end that have a beginning, the curtain goes down and the actors retire to the green room. And there the villain and the hero cease to be villain and hero, and they're just the actor. And then they come out in front of the curtain and they stand in a row and the audience applauds the villain along with the hero. The villain for having been a good villain. The hero for having been a great hero. The play is over. And everybody heaves a sigh of relief. Well, that was a great show, wasn't it? So the same idea. The green room is the Nirguna Brahman. That behind the whole show, where there are no differentiations of I and thou, subject and object, good and evil, light and darkness, life and death. But within the sphere of the Saguna Brahman, all these differentiations appear, because that's out in front, that's on the stage. And no good actor, when on the stage, performs his own personality. That's what's wrong with movie stars. They try to cast a person to act a role which corresponds to his alleged personality. But a great actor can assume any kind of personality, male or female, can suddenly convert himself right in front of the audience into somebody who takes you in entirely. But in the green room, he's his usual self. So Hinduism has the idea then, you see, it's all the conventions of drama go right along with it. That all this world is a big act, Leela, the play of the Supreme Self. And it's therefore compared to a dream, to a passing illusion, and you should not therefore take it seriously. You may take it sincerely, perhaps, as an actor may be sincere in his acting, but not serious, because that means it throws you for a loop. Although that, of course, is involved. We do take it seriously. But you see, one of the great questions that you have to ask yourself, when you really get down to the nitty-gritty about your own inmost core, is, are you serious? Or do you know deep within you that you're a put-on?
Your It continues with Session 8, Oriental Philosophy in the West, Part 1.
I wonder what you would do if you had the power to dream at night any dream you wanted to dream. And you would, of course, be able to alter your time sense and slip, say, 75 years of subjective time into 8 hours of sleep. You would, I suppose, start out by fulfilling all your wishes. You could design for yourself what would be the most ecstatic life. Love affairs, banquets, dancing girls, wonderful journeys, gardens, music beyond belief. And then after a couple of months of this sort of thing, at 75 years a night, you'd be getting a little taste for something different. And you would move over to an adventurous dimension, where there were certain dangers involved, and the thrill of dealing with dangers. And you could rescue princesses from dragons, and go on dangerous journeys, make wonderful explosions and blow them up, and eventually get into contest with enemies. And after you've done that for some time, you'll think up a new wrinkle to forget that you were dreaming, so that you would think it was all for real, and to be anxious about it. And then, because it'd be so great when you woke up, and then you say, well, like children who dare each other on things, how far out could you get? What could you take? What dimension of being lost, of abandonment of your power, what dimension of that could you stand? You could ask yourself this because you know you'd eventually wake up. And after you'd gone on doing this, you see, for some time, you would suddenly find yourselves sitting around in this room with all your personal involvements, problems, etc., talking with me. How do you know that's not what you're doing? Could be. Because after all, what would you do if you were God? If you were what there is, the self. In the Upanishads, the basic texts of Hinduism, one of them starts out saying, in the beginning was the self. And looking around, it said, I am. And thus it is that everyone to this day, when asked who is there, says it is I, and thereafter gives whatever particular name he may have. For if you were God, and in this sense that you knew everything, and you were completely transparent to yourself through and through, you would be bored. Because if, looking at it from another way, we push technology to its furthest possible development, and we had, instead of a dial telephone on one's desk, a more complex system of buttons, and one touch, beep, would give you anything you wanted. Aladdin's lamp. You would eventually have to introduce a button labeled surprise. Because all perfectly known futures, as I pointed out, are past. They have happened, virtually. It is only the true future is a surprise. So if you were God, you would say to yourself, man, get lost. And it's strange that this idea is obscurely embedded in the Christian tradition, when in the Epistle to the Philippians, St. Paul speaks of God the Son, the Logos, the Word of God, who is incarnate in Christ, and says, let this mind be in you which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought not equality with God a thing to be clung to, but made himself of no reputation, and humbled himself, and was found in fashion as a man, and became obedient to death. Same idea. Same idea as the idea of the dream. When you get in that very far out dream of getting as extreme as you can get. And so this then is the basis of the Hindu view of the universe and of man. The Hindu looks upon the universe as a drama. The Westerner, of course, looks upon the universe as a construct, as something made. And it is not, therefore, insignificant that Jesus was the son of a carpenter. The Chinese looks upon the universe as an organism, as we shall subsequently see. But the dramatic idea is basic to Hinduism. Now, you can speak about Hinduism on two levels, at least. One I will call the metaphysical level, and the other the mythological level. If you speak on the metaphysical level, you can speak only in negative language. You can say what the divine, the ultimate reality, is not. If you speak on the mythological level, you may speak of what the divine is like, because myth is not a falsehood, as one uses the word in a sophisticated way. A myth is an image, a concrete image, in terms of which man makes sense of the world. And thus the idea of God the Father or God the Maker is a myth, because it's an image. And Christian theologians distinguish equally between two kinds of theological language, which are respectively called cataphatic and apophatic. Apophatic language is negative, as when we say God is infinite and eternal. Cataphatic language is mythological, as when we say God the Father, God is love, and all the positive designations. We are not saying God is a cosmic male parent, but is analogous with the Father. So with Hinduism. But what I'm going to speak to you in, first of all, is the mythological language of Hinduism. The idea of the universe as the big act. The universe is God playing hide and seek with himself.
For God is thought of fundamentally to the Hindu as the self, the self, the cosmic I. And it is a basic proposition for the Hindu that only the self, the Godhead, is real. There is nothing other than the Godhead. So that the appearance, the feeling that there are other things than the Godhead is called Maya. Maya. We ordinarily translate that word illusion. But you must be careful about the word illusion. Illusion is related to the Latin ludere. And that means play. And this is why the analogy of the world is dramatic. It's a play. In the sense of a stage play. Now, when you go to the theater, you know what you're going to see is not for real. Because the proscenium arch tells you that. That everything that happens on the far side of that arch is only in play, not serious. But the actor, and you will hope that he will be good at it, is going to try and persuade you that it's for real. So that he will so move you that you are crying or sitting in anxiety upon the edge of your chair. And so the audience is almost persuaded to be taken in. Now what about if this would happen with the very best actor of all, the great actor? The audience would of course be completely taken in. But in this case, of course, the actor and the audience are the same, the self. The self has thus the capacity to abandon itself, to forget itself, to hide from itself, and thus to make the most completely convincing illusion, but in play. And so the activity, the creative activity of the Godhead in Hinduism is called Leela, which means play. Our word lilt is related to it, I think. But so also in the book of Proverbs, you will find a discourse being given by the divine wisdom. The Lord possessed me in the beginning of his ways before his works of old. I think it's the 22nd chapter of Proverbs, in the course of which the wisdom says that its delight was to rejoice, the King James Bible says, in the presence of God and with the sons of men. But the Hebrew translated rejoice says play. Rejoice is a sort of dignified Elizabethan. But it says play. And St. Thomas, aware of this, said that the divine wisdom was above all to be compared with games. Because games are played for their own sake and not for any sort of ulterior motive. So also music is a kind of non-purposive thing because you don't either play music to reach a destination nor do you dance to reach a particular place on the floor. It is the doing of it itself that is important because after all, if the object of music were to gain a certain destination, those orchestras that played fastest would be considered the best. So the idea is that that dancing and music, more than other arts, represent the nature of this world. That it is playful, that it is sport. That it may be sincere, but is definitely not serious. And as G.K. Chesterton well put it once, the angels fly because they take themselves lightly. How much more so the Lord of the angels. So if a beautiful lady should say to me, I love you, and I were to reply, "Are you serious or are you just playing with me?" That would be quite the wrong response, because I hope she's not serious and that she will play with me. I should say, "Are you sincere or are you just toying with me?" Because, you see, the word play has many different senses. A person who is playing the organ in church is certainly not doing something trivial. When you go to see a play called Hamlet, you are not seeing something trivial. When the concert artist plays Mozart, he is certainly entertaining you, but it's not a trivial entertainment. But on the other hand, we would use play in quite a different sense when we mean just fooling around, doing it for kicks. So it is fundamental, as a matter of fact, to both the Hindu and the Christian traditions that the universe is the play of God. But the Christian thinks of it in the terms of a construction play, like building with blocks. And the Hindu thinks of it as dramatic play, of the actual participation of the Godhead in the creation, so that every being whatsoever is God in disguise. Hinduism speaks of the Godhead as, uses the word Brahman. This is a neuter form in Sanskrit from the root bri, which means to grow, to expand, to swell. The neuter form Brahman does not have quite the connotation then, you see, of kingship that we will find attached to the Western idea of God, but is also referred to as Atman. And this word we translate ordinarily the self. So you can have the para param, you put the M in to connect the particle, paramatman, which means para, the supreme self, or sometimes just the Atman alone, and that means the self in you. But the fundamental principle of Indian philosophy is Atman is Brahman. Yourself is the supreme self. Or it is expressed also in the formula Tat Tvam Asi. Colloquially translated, you're it. Or tat, that, tuam, Latin tuam, you, asi, are. You are that thou art. Tat, of course, is the first word uttered by a baby. Da, 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 da. And fathers flatter themselves that it's saying da-da. It's not. It's saying that. And so it's pointing to thatness in everything. It's very important to see this. Because everything is just that. I can say it in a negative way, which you won't appreciate at first, perhaps. Everything is meaningless. Only words have meaning, because they point to something other than themselves. The sound water is undrinkable, but it points to the drinkable reality. When you say, though, what is that pointing at the water, and somebody says water, he's not being correct, because what you're pointing at is not the noise water. So it's not water. It's that. Da. And water's a kind of jazz. And it's just doing that. And you can get to see, too, people are a kind of jazz. They talk and communicate with each other, but what does that mean? Well, they get together and they make more people and they do this and they do that and they eat and they go on doing this jazz, but it's just jazz. And you begin to see, as you do that, everything's like music, you see. It's all these complicated vibrations going ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo in all kinds of ways. That's that, or thatness, ta-ta-ta, also called in Sanskrit. So anyway, this is the fundamental notion that you are really what there is, the works. Only you're playing hide-and-seek with yourself. And on a stupendous scale. Hindus measure time in units which in Sanskrit are called kalpa. And a kalpa is a period of 4,320,000 years. And there are two kinds of kalpa. One is called manvantara, and the other is called pralaya. Manvantara is the kalpa in which the universe is manifested, in other words, in which God puts on his big act. And pralaya is the succeeding kalpa in which the universe is unmanifested. And the Godhead does not dream, but is awake to its own nature. These are called, respectively, the days and the nights of the Brahman. And this goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. The days and nights adding up into years and centuries and eons. They speak of crore. There's a Sanskrit measure, crore, C-R-O-R-E. A sort of a word that really, I think, means umpteen. Crores of kalpas. And this is the in-breathing and the out-breathing. There's the word hamsa. And this word in Sanskrit, hamsa, means a swan or a big water bird, like a gander. There's a myth that there is in the beginning the divine bird which lays the egg of the world. And the egg splits, and the upper is the heavens and the lower is the earth. So when the worlds are manifested, the Lord breathing out says, hung. And when the worlds are withdrawn, the breath comes back, hung. But if you say hung sa hung sa hung sa hung, it becomes sa hung sa hung sa ahung. That means sa means that, the truth, ahung, I am that. It's like imagine when we get to the final moment in which the world is blown up. You know, imagine the countdown. This is the end. Somebody's pushed the button. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What are you listening to? Sound of the waves. And you can sit and listen to the little waves on the seashore. And you get back here into this kind of thinking, and you're hearing the ocean of the universe going. And that's your breathing too. It's all one rhythm. So it may be that every star was once a planet populated by intelligent people who found out about the fundamental energy of the universe and blew themselves up. And as they blew up, they scattered all kinds of stuff out, which became little planets. Which in a long time, life started all over again. Because the Hindu theory is very odd. Every kalpa in the Manvantara period, where there's a manifested world, is divided into four subdivisions of time, each one of which is called a yuga. That means roughly an epoch or an era. And there are four yugas, and they're named after the different throws in the Indian game of dice. There are four such throws, and the first is called Krita. That means, Kri means to do, as when we say something is done, truly done. It's the perfect throw of four. The second is called Treta, which is the throw of three. The next is called Dvapara, which is the throw of two. And the final one is called Kali, which means the worst throw, which is the throw of one. Now, each of these periods of the Kalpa are of different lengths. Krita is the longest, and Kali is the shortest, and so ranged. So that when the world is first manifested, as in those dreams that I were mentioning to you, the world is in a golden age to begin with. It's perfect. And that is the longest period of time. Then when we get a little bit more adventurous, you see, the Treta means that in this era, a kind of disharmonious element enters into things. It's like a three-legged chair isn't so secure as a four-legged chair. It's just a bit inclined to tip. And as it were, as a fly in the ointment, the snake in the garden. Then comes Dvapara, in which the forces of good and evil are equally balanced. And finally, Kali, which is the shortest period, where the forces of evil are triumphant, and the world is destroyed at the end of it. For then the Godhead appears in the form of Shiva, who represents the destructive aspect of the divine energy, and whereas Brahma is the creative, Vishnu the preserver, Shiva the destroyer. But Shiva is always the destroyer in the sense of the liberator, the guy who breaks up the ruts. And he comes on with a blue body and 10 arms and a necklace of skulls. Indian gods have many arms because they are cosmic centipedes. They do all things without having to think about it, like the centipede doesn't have to think about how to manipulate its legs, like you don't have to think how to grow your hair. And as Shiva dances what is called the Tandava, which is the dance of destruction at the end of the cycle, at the end of the Kalpa, you will see that his hands contain clubs and knives and bells, but one hand is like that. And that gesture means, don't be afraid, it's a big act. It is all, as it were, the outflowing of your own consciousness, of your own mind. Now then, Hindu life is related to this cosmology. And the objective of life is, of course, in the end, to wake up from the dream when you've had enough. And so the dreaming process is called sometimes samsara. Samsara is the round, the rat race. And samsara is divided into six divisions. I better draw a map, I think. This is common, you see, cosmology to both the Hindus and the Buddhists. This is the world of the Deva. And this is the same root from which we get both divine and devil. But Deva means angel. The highest and most successful beings in the universe. And so opposite, this is the world of Naraka, who are the most unsuccessful. These are the purgatorial worlds of extreme suffering. This is the world of Asura. They are also angels, but they're angry angels, representing the wrath potential of energy. This is the world of animals. This is the world of Preta, for which we have no English equivalent. They are hungry or frustrated spirits who have enormous stomachs but mouths only the size of needles. Vast appetite and no means of fulfillment. And this is the Manu world, that is to say, the world of man. You don't have to take this literally. You could say, when you're extremely happy or ecstatic, you're here. When you are miserable, you're here. When you're dumb, you're here. When you're mad, you're here. When you're frustrated, you're here. But when you're more or less your normal, rational self, you're here. Now, so all life, through the period of the kalpas, goes grinding around this wheel. And if you go up and you succeed and you get to the top, you have to come down. They don't see success, in other words, in the world as a method of liberation, because it implies failure. So the idea of liberation, which is called moksha, is the ideal of Hindu life. Wake up, it's a dream. And in time, there is no hope in time. Everything is going to get worse in time. Because, as you know, it does. We all fall apart in the end. Everything falls apart. Institutions, buildings, nations, it all crumbles. And people say, well, that's an awfully pessimistic philosophy. Well, is it? I would rather say that the people who have hope in the future are the miserable people. Because they're like donkeys chasing carrots that are dangled before their noses from sticks attached to their collars. And they pursue and they pursue in vain, always hoping that tomorrow will be the great thing, and therefore incapable of enjoying themselves today. People who live for the future never get there, because when their plans mature, they are not there to enjoy them. They're the sort of people who spend their lives saving for their old age and trying to teach their children to do the same thing, so that when they retire at 65, you know, they have false teeth and wrinkles and prostate trouble and all that sort of thing. Where were you going? What did you think it was all about? Furthermore, the fact that life is transient is part of its liveliness. The poets, in speaking of the transience of the world, always utter their best poetry. You know, our revels now are ended, and these our actors, as I foretold you, are all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great earth itself, I, all which it inherits, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. And said so well, it doesn't seem so bad after all, does it? You see, there's always in the poetry of evanescence a kind of funny nostalgia. Moralists will say, those lovely lips which you so delight to kiss today will in a few years rot and disclose the grinning teeth of a skull. So what? The skull says, lying in the grass, chattering finch and waterfly are not merrier than I. Here among the flowers I lie, laughing everlastingly. No, I may not tell the best. Surely, friends, I could have guessed. Death was but the good king's jest. It was hid so carefully. And monks used to keep skulls on their desks. And people nowadays think that was very morbid. I went and visited a chapel in the Via Veneto in Rome, where there's a crypt where all the altar furnishings are made out of human bones. The altars are piles of skulls. There are rib bones arranged across the ceiling like floral patterns, with vertebrae representing flowers. And they're all dead Capuchin monks. And there's a funny little monk collecting the admissions up at the top. And he has one of the funniest grins on his face I've seen in a long time. I said to him, you know, on the day of resurrection, there's going to be an awful lot of scuttling up this narrow staircase. People trying to reassemble their bones. Oh, dear Father, isn't that my fifth metatarsal? So, the whole idea, you see, is that everything's falling apart. So don't try and stop it. When you're falling off a precipice, it doesn't do you any good to hang on to a rock that's falling with you. See? But everything is doing that. And so, again, this is another case of our completely wasting our energy in trying to prevent the world from falling apart. Don't do it. And then you'll be able to do something interesting with the free energy. So that's moksha. Because when the Hindu says everything is unreal, the Westerner reacts and says, no, no, you can't treat life as a dream. It's serious. It's real. It's for real. And what do you mean by that? Well, how real do you want it to be? This is, in other words, everything, insofar as it's falling apart, everything is changing, it is like smoke. And we all feel that smoke has a lesser degree of reality than wood. It's an image of the evanescent, of the ghostly. So there's this idea, the whole world is this mirage. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's only bad if you cling to it, if you try to lean on it. But if you don't lean on it, it's a grand illusion. So the word maya means not only illusion, but it means art, it means magic, and it means creative power. So this is the big act. And it's perhaps easier to feel the world in that way in a tropical country where death is very common and where you just watch things dissolve before your eyes and yet burst out and grow again. The whole world is changing. Maybe easier to think that way than in our environment. Although when you're out in California, the human landscape changes so fast that no town is the same for 2 years. Any mailing list that you have changes 1/3 addresses per annum. Nothing stays put. The hills are shadows and they flow from form to form and nothing stands. Now, this, you see, is not a pessimistic attitude, therefore, at all. To be able to realize that this world is simply a dream. A dancing play of smoke. Fascinating, yes, but don't lean on it. Life is a bridge, says one of the Hindu sayings. Pass over it, but build no house upon it. And so immediately you see that. This is responsible for the enormous gaiety of certain Hindu sages. This is a thing that often puzzles Westerners. The element of they expected anybody who's an ascetic or a sage or something to be rather miserable, with a glum face. But on the contrary, you take this character who's going around these days, Maharshi Mahesh, he's always laughing. Because he sees through it. He looks on every side, and there is the face of the beloved, of the divinity, in everybody, in every direction, in everything, playing at being you. And you can look down into a person's eyes, way, way in, and you see the self, the eternal divine. And what is so funny, when it puts on an expression, saying, what, me? And the guru, the teacher. When people go to a guru, they get all sorts of funny ideas. They think, oh, he's looking right through me. He sees me through and through. He knows how awful I am. Reads my most secret thoughts. Because he has a funny look in his face. He isn't even interested in your secret thoughts. He's looking straight at the Godhead in you, with a funny expression on his face, which is saying, why are you trying to kid me? Come off it, Shiva, I know who you are. But, and therefore, you see, his role is to gently humor you into waking up as to your true nature. Now, of course, as I intimated earlier, the Hindu is therefore saying everybody is God. And this is why when a Hindu greets you, he does this. That is the act of puja, or worship, to the Godhead in you. And our theologians get rather worried about that, because, you see, the two conceptions of God are different. Our conception is of the boss man, the king. Theirs is of the cosmic centipede with the many arms, who does not have to think how to make the world, or rather to act the world. That would be an insufferable nuisance. You may think it rather wonderful when St. Thomas tries to explain that God is fully aware of everything that happens, and in every detail is willing each single vibration of any mosquito's wing. But when you really begin to think about it, that approaches intellectual elephantiasis. God heard the embattled nation shout, God strafe England, and God save the king. God this, God that, and God the other thing. Good God, said God, I've got my work cut out. So therefore, when somebody in India suddenly announces that he's God, nobody accuses him of blasphemy or of being insane. They say simply, congratulations, at last you found out. And they don't immediately request a miracle. As you see, if we get across someone who says, I'm God or I'm Jesus Christ, they say what they said to Jesus Christ in the first place. Command that this bread, these stones, be made bread. And you know, he used to wangle out of it by saying, a wicked and deceitful generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given. The Hindu would say, but there is no point in changing it. It's going the way I want it to anyhow. Only really and truly, there is not this idea of God the technician, but rather the power of omnipotence is not to be able to do anything, but to be doing all things, whatever it is that's going on, and spontaneously, without having to think about it, which is very clumsy. Now then, I must say something about how then this relates to the life of the Hindu. Hindu divide life into certain stages. what are called the ashramas. The first is called brahmacharya, the second grihastha, and the third vanaprastha. Brahmacharya means the stage of the student, the apprenticeship. Grihastha, the stage of the householder. And vanaprastha, the stage of the forest dweller. This is related to cultural history of early India. Before we have agrarian communities, we have a hunting culture, which is on the move. In a hunting culture, every male knows the whole culture. There is no division of labor. And the holy man of the hunting culture is, of course, called a shaman. A shaman is a realized man, a man who knows the inner secret. He's seen through the game. And he finds it by going away alone into the forest and cutting himself off from the tribe. That is to say, from social conditioning. And he goes maybe for a long period into the forest and comes back. He's found out who he is. And he sure isn't who he was told he was. But as hunting cultures settle into agrarian patterns of life, what do? They build a village. And around the village they set up a stockade, which is known as the pale. And the village is always, of course, standing at crossroads. And there you get in an agrarian society a division of labor. And the division of labor comprises four. In medieval Europe, we call them lords spiritual, lords temporal, commons, and serfs. In India, they are Brahmins, Kshatriya, that means fighters, Vaishya, merchants, traders, Shudra, laborers. So you've got the priests, the warriors, the merchants, and the laborers. Division of labor. The four sections of town. And so the four basic castes. So when you are born into a caste, and your duty as a grihastha or householder is to fulfill your caste function and to bring up a family. When you've done that, you go back to the forest, back to the hunting culture, and you drop your role, and you become nobody. A shaman again. So a Hindu calls one who does this a shramana, which is, of course, the same word as shaman. And the Chinese call him a xia mun. Shaman. A shaman is an immortal. Why immortal? Because it's only the role that's mortal. The big front, the persona. The one who you really are, the common man, that is to say, the man who is common to us all, which you could call the son of man, that's the real self. That's the guy who's putting on the big act. And, of course, he has no name. Nobody can put the finger on him, because you can't touch the tip of the finger with the tip of the finger. So that means in practice, then, that when you hand over your vocation in life, which is called your svadharma, that means sva, that's the same as the Latin suus, one's own. Dharma means function. Your own function, or we would call your vocation. When you've completed it, you drop out and become nobody, because you're going to find out now who you really are. You're no longer Mr. Mukhopadhyaya, who is a cloth salesman. You drop that name and you take on one of the names of God, Swami Brahmananda, Swami Bliss of Brahman. And you may go quite naked, like the Shivite holy men. No clothes. And they just go out and wander and don't make any provision for anything. They take no thought for the morrow, what you shall eat, what you shall drink, or wherewithal they shall be clothed. But you see, people respect them. They say, yeah, we've got to have those people up there, because they are doing what human being is ultimately supposed to do, and we shall do it in our turn. And so give them some food. Now, naturally, caste, holy men, and all that kind of thing can be exploited. Anything can be exploited and abused. And we can look at it all and say, what a mess. Why don't you do something for yourselves? Why don't you kill the sacred cows and eat them? Why don't you clean up? Why do you permit all this disease? Just try and see something from another point of view for a change. I'm not saying that we should do what the Hindus do, but just look at it from another point of view. And they would smile at us and say, you really think it's as real as all that? Have you never experienced what's on the inside of this game? See, the trouble with you Westerners is you've never experienced bliss. You've never got down to the root of reality. You don't know that state of consciousness. And so you're frantically trying to patch everything up and pin it all together and screw the universe up so that it's fixed. You can never do it. All it is again, wildly rushing around and creating trouble. Of course, Western educated Hindus think the same way. They are now for rushing around and patching India up. And what's going to happen is they're going to arm all the millions of people in India. And they're going to create a lot of trouble in Asia one of these days when they become powerful society. When you read Milton's Paradise Lost, long before Lucifer decided to rebel, the whole of heaven was armed. And he describes the legions of angels with their escutcheons and gonfalons and military deportment. Who was looking for trouble? Lucifer was a good guy back then, see? The bearer of light. So the Hindu looks at our Christianity, though, and sort of thinks, my goodness, here is the eternal self. But in the idea of Christianity, the Godhead is having a real far-out one. Because not only is he incarnating himself, say, as some wretched beggar, but he's incarnated himself as a Christian soul who believes that in this one short life he will decide his eternal destiny. And the possibilities of making a mistake are far greater than of being a lousy beggar. The possibility involved in the Christian gamble is to fry in hell forever and ever and ever and ever. Even the Avicii hell at the bottom of the Naraka only goes on for about one kalpa. But the everlasting damnation, what an idea. So the Hindu says, bravo, God has really done a dare on himself this time to be a Christian soul.